This is the Dutch International Service, Radio Netherlands. As part of our 50th anniversary celebrations, we present the third programme in our series looking at Radio Netherlands' development and output during the past decades. With material from our archives, Piet Myers turns the clock back to the 1950s.
I'm a child of the 50s. It's the decade that is indelibly imprinted in my consciousness, and the decade that shaped my values and aspirations. It's only now that historians are beginning to appreciate this extraordinary era of transition, which gave us prosperity, jobs for all, booming production, the birth of youth culture, and our first awe-inspiring ventures into space. It's in fact a fascinating decade. And how it was reflected by Radio Netherlands is what we'll explore in this half hour. You know, it's often thought that the 50s were a grey, somber, conservative period. And yes, it was to begin. It was an orderly era with little social dissent. The young, like myself, largely accepting the status quo and aspiring to the same things as our fathers. Women were programmed to believe that their natural place was the home. Getting married, bearing children, and buying your own home was the natural order. But all of this was to change dramatically by the end of the decade and open the floodgates to the turbulent 60s. In Europe, the nations devastated by World War II were on the road to recovery, and there was a general mood of optimism in the air, despite the Cold War, the division of this continent, and the threat of nuclear holocaust. It was the age of the gadget, and booming America led the way. The United States was a powerhouse of scientific and technical innovation. Gadgets to wash, cook, clean, and mow the lawn. The automobile transformed their social and working life, and in practically every American parlor, there was the box that transformed communication, television. I can assure you, we in Europe looked across the great pond in envy. And to rub salt in our envious green wounds, they even had her.
The deedly 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 dum, poop poopy doop.
The decade's most unforgettable icon, whose image is still as potent today as it was 40 years ago. Marilyn Monroe, of course. Because of the enormous role American aid played in the post-war reconstruction of Holland, relations between our two nations were at a high point, and in 1952, Queen Juliana of the Netherlands paid a highly publicized state visit to America. In Washington, she addressed a special session of the U.S. Congress.
We feel we appear here in the name of a nation of your comrades in the recent war, that crusade against evil in which each performed his particular part. A brotherhood was born there in the depth of distress and in the height of joy. The Dutch people hold in deep respect and grateful memory your brave men who sacrificed their lives wherever we've been fighting side by side.
Queen Juliana in Washington. Meanwhile, back on the home front, a young teenager of 14 was sharing her views in a rare Radio Netherlands interview. Speaking in Dutch, she revealed her musical taste. Here first is a short translation of the snippet I'm playing.
I don't have an extensive record collection, but I do have some records by Doris Day and some waltzes by Strauss and lots of yodel songs. My favourite record at the moment belongs to Daddy. It's by an Indian singer who can sing very high and very low. It's very beautiful. Her name is Ima Sumac.
Well, you know, come to think of it, I was very partial to Doris Day too when I was 14, and I guess I still am. the future queen of this country. Then Princess Beatrix talking about her favorite pop music. And here's the original version.
Dat is niet bepaald uitgebreid, maar we hebben wel een paar platen van Doris Day en ook een paar walsen van Strauss en veel jodeliedjes en zo.
En is er een plaat bij waarvan u zegt, ja, dat is een uitgesproken lievelingsplaat?
Nou, hij is niet bepaald van ons, maar papi heeft een hele mooie van een Indiaanse zangeres die heel hoog en heel laag kan zingen. Ze heet Hima Sumak. Ik weet de plaat niet precies, maar het is heel mooi.
The extraordinary Hima Sumak, who had a vocal range between 3 and 5 octaves and claimed that she was an Inca princess from the Peruvian Andes. In fact, she came from Brooklyn, but then, in those good old days, we fell for the hype. And back then, the English service of Radio Netherlands was still operating out of its villa in Hilversum. Working conditions were primitive compared to today's setup, but our worldwide audience was beginning to expand. Keeping in touch with the Dutch was our motto, and in comparison to other major shortwave broadcasters, we were something of a curiosity, but a likable one. In the 50s, our output started becoming less parochial. I mean, there was only so much one could say about cheese, clogs, and tulips, and became more cosmopolitan, with the emphasis on interviews, usually with celebrities visiting the lowlands. A celebrity like Winifred Atwell, who hailed from the Caribbean and was a huge 50s star in Britain and extremely popular in Europe. She could be described today as the female equivalent of Fats Waller and sold millions of records playing on her famous honky-tonk piano.
I must tell you that from the plane, looking down in Holland, I was very struck by how neat and precise everything looked. All the little fields, you know, they were just in little rows, quite correct and proper.
Yes, and we were quite interested to know how she selected her other pianos.
Well, just so that it sounds right to me, you know.
Yes.
As a matter of fact, I have to look out that there are not too many woodworms in it. But I got into trouble with one. My second one, I did a recording at the Decca Studios and left it there. And then I was getting frantic calls to come and take this piano away because the woodworm was getting into the studio.
Getting into the studio and the other piano too, I suppose.
So eventually they got someone to take it off them for 2 and 6.
2 and 6. And hands up all you Brits who can remember what that was in real money. That was a clip from our popular feature program in 53, Window on Holland. Now, if you ask any Dutch person what was the most eventful domestic story of the 50s in this country, they will unanimously pinpoint the early hours of February 1st, 1953, when Holland suffered its greatest natural disaster of the century. An unusually high spring tide, coupled with hurricane-force winds, created a terrifying situation on the islands in the southeast of the country. During the night, the boiling sea breached the dikes and flooded large areas of the region. There was great loss of life, 1,800 souls, property and livestock. In such an emergency, Radio Netherlands rose to the occasion, and in appalling conditions, our reporters were on the scene informing the world of the catastrophe.
This is Robin Simpson speaking from the island of Walcheren in the southwest corner of Holland. As our earlier broadcasts have told you, 1/6 of the Netherlands has been inundated. And although the waters which have broken down the dikes have receded to some extent, there still remains much to be learned from vast areas which have been cut off as a result of severed communications. Cattle, crops, and foodstuffs have been destroyed by the sea's ravages.
This is Walt Richter speaking from a KLM Dakota DC-3 above the flooded disaster area. We left Schiphol Airport about a half an hour ago and have been steadily flying south. This disaster rate, I think, is the greatest in Holland's history for the past 300 years. We're 40 miles inland, and still we see seagulls cruising over the waves. The spirit of the Dutchman here... I have,
during the night, toured these islands in the southwest of Holland and seen, with the aid of searchlights, much of the devastation. Inhabitants in outlying farmhouses have been rescued from their rooftops or nearby trees. The storm has abated, but...
As I've been talking to you, I've been looking out of the window of the plane over the wing, and just down below now, we're coming over a vast flooded area with whole villages underwater. We just see the rooftops.
It's frightfully cold. It's now just coming up for 5:30 in the morning, and I'm going towards a party of men who are working with a huge pile of sandbags, and they're trying to bridge a gap in a dike.
Oh, Mr. Gilmore, what is your impression so far of this wonderful work you're putting in here?
It's a bit hopeless. At times our sandbags, as we put them in, are swept away, but it's a problem of just keep on going through. Certainly it is much better with the wind down and the tide not so high.
The tide is down now, and you feel that you are actually gaining ground, do you?
Oh, certainly.
So, from Middelburg, in the island of Walcheren in the south of Holland, I return you now to the studio.
The disaster touched the world's hearts, and over 60 nations provided aid to the stricken Netherlands, in one form or another. It was an extraordinary act of generosity, and when the crisis abated, Queen Juliana broadcast a message via Radio Netherlands.
We in the Netherlands are deeply grateful to you for your magnificent aid. Individually and in groups, you have made great sacrifices for us. You've taken great pains, and you've given, above everything, your heart. The result was a very effective help. In the way in which you've come to our assistance, you have stimulated in us the desire to reciprocate in like manner where and when it might be necessary. We shall always remember what you have done for us.
And we remembered, because some of the nations who came to Holland's aid were Cuba, Mozambique, El Salvador, India, and Pakistan, nations in the early stages of their development. When, a decade later, this country became a major contributor to global development aid, that bond of friendship was not forgotten. In the same year of the disaster, a legendary French performer came to town, one noted for his straw hat, his fractured English accent, and a winning humor. Elements that can still be savored in the numerous films he made in France and Hollywood. Though long gone, we remember Maurice Chevalier well, and the song that was his trademark. In our archive is a marvelous recording of a concert he gave at the Kerr House, our grand hotel on the beach, one of the pearls in our collection. And on it, this magical moment when he sang Louise.
Every little breeze seems to whisper Louise. Birds in the trees seem to twitter Louise. Each little rose tells me it knows I love you. Love you, every little bit that I feel in my heart seems to repeat what I felt at the start. Each little sigh tells me that I adore you, Louise. Just to see and hear you is joy I never knew. But to be so near you thrills me through and through. Anyone can see why I wanted your kiss. It had to be, but the wonder is this. Can it be true someone like you could love me, Louise? Alors, s'il vous plaît, hein?
La-di-da-da-dum-dum-dum, even I know that. And it's a pity to fade that moment. But we only do it to make way for a diamond in our archive collection. This is an anecdote you can dine out on for months. In 1956, the nation celebrated the 350th birthday of our most famous artist, Rembrandt. We made a series of special programs to mark the occasion. And in the last came this extraordinary story, as told by the museum director of the Municipal Museum in The Hague.
There's a beautiful story about the sale of the contents of a castle in Brabant, one of the provinces of Holland, at the turn of the century. At that particular moment, the last of the noble family of Van Beresteyn died, and his possessions were put up for sale, amongst them two very large canvases used in spring to put them under the chimneys, and then the chimney sweep swept all the soot from the chimney on the canvas. It worked very well in darkening the pictures, of course. Besides, it kept the floors of the rooms clean. In autumn again, they used the canvases for drying apples on them. But at the sale, a dealer from Amsterdam bought them for some guilders. I do believe 50 guilders or something like that. He took them home and he cleaned them, and he found that those were the Rembrandt pictures, Rembrandt portraits, known in the family, but thought lost. And you can see them any day now because they are in the Metropolitan Museum in New York.
And I wish I knew the particular portraits referred to in that priceless anecdote or the name of the person relating it. But unfortunately, the people who started our archive decades ago were extremely cavalier when it came to labelling things. All too often, names of the broadcasters and the people they interviewed were omitted, and it's impossible in many cases to credit people 40 years on. However, in this next extract, I can tell you that the interviewer's name was R. Richards. Heaven knows what the R stood for. And he talked to a woman who needed no introduction in 1956. She was, in fact, the most potent symbol of black sexuality in Europe. Star of the Folies Bergères, heroine of the French Resistance, gracious and witty. She came to Paris as a girl of 19 from the United States and took it by storm in 1925. With her feathers, bananas, and magnificent breasts, which she had no qualms exposing to her audience, she quickly established herself as a legendary entertainer of the interwar years. In 1950, she announced her retirement and embarked on a farewell tour that lasted 25 years. When she arrived in Holland, aged 50, to say the first of her many goodbyes, she was equally famous for her adopted children, her rainbow tribe that numbered 7 then. She and her husband finally ended up with 12, I believe, and, of course, became role model for Mio Farrow decades later. Obviously, I'm talking about Josephine Baker, who even at 50 was much too glamorous to retire. So she was asked.
Could you tell us why, Miss Baker, this is a farewell tour?
Well, because I have a family now. I mean a small family. I've always had family. That is an enormous family, family of the world. But this time, I have one very precious family, and that is a small tribe. I call this tribe the Rainbow Tribe because they are of all colors, all races, and all religions. They are my 7 little boys that I just recently adopted.
And the Rainbow Tribe, could you give us the nationalities of these 7 boys?
You take me by surprise because I don't think that people have nationalities. I believe we're all brothers, and border lines don't exist for me.
The land of their birth, then.
That's it. I prefer that. Thank you. Yes, well, one is Korean, one Japanese, one South African, one Mexican Indian, one Finland, and also 2 Parisians.
And are you planning on adding to your tribe?
Oh, why not? If I can make children happy, I will gladly do so.
J'attendrai le jour et la nuit, j'attendrai toujours ton retour. J'attendrai car l'oiseau qui s'enfuit vient chercher l'oubli dans son nid. Le temps passe et court en battant tristement dans mon cœur plus lourd. Mais pourtant, j'attendrai ton retour.
Unforgettable Josephine Baker, who died in 1975, a day after her greatest comeback performance, age 69. Now, if there's one place both the Dutch and the millions of tourists who visit us love, it's the heart of Amsterdam, the famous Dam Square, flanked by the historic palace and new church on one side and the National Monument on the other. Once a year, since the 4th of May, 1956, the day it was unveiled, the monument is where monarch and nation pay tribute to the dead of World War II. May the 4th is our National Remembrance Day. And when that monument was first revealed, our reporter, Alan Rau, was on the scene.
The National Monument was paid for completely by the Netherlands people. The Dam Square, on which the monument is located, was actually sold to the people of the Netherlands. They were asked to buy 1 square millimeter of soil in the Dam Square and to pay for that 50 cents only. Consequently, 4,795,150 square millimeters of soil of the Dam Square were sold to the Dutch people so that this monument could be raised to commemorate the dead of World War II. The total money raised was between $600,000 and $700,000. The architect, J.J.P. Oud, and the sculptor, John Redacker, were chosen to plan the monument. And after 10 years' work, on today, May the 4th, 1956, the monument is finished. The 11 urns, which were placed in the provisional monument containing the earth from the 11 provinces of Holland, have been taken to Nieuwkerk in Amsterdam, and in the ceremony have been moved to be placed in the niches of this new national monument.
And it's still the favorite place for people to meet, if you don't mind the junkies and dealers who hang out there these days. I tell you, times have changed. But back in the mid-50s, when we all lusted for Coke, we meant the drink, and that innocence was reflected in our various shows. In particular, the most popular, Window on Holland. If a celebrity hit town, Radio Netherlands was sure to get a soundbite.
Peggy Ashcroft, the British actress appearing in the title role of Ibsen's Hedda Gabler.
Of course, this isn't the first time that I have played in Holland, and both before when I was here and this time, one of the chief impressions that I have is the remarkable way in which your audiences seem to understand our language. I mean, there is no foreign company that could come to England and expect to be understood as we seem to be understood here.
Yes,
which, of course, is a great delight to us and makes playing very much easier.
Easter came, and soon after, Gary Cooper. He was put on a bit of a spot by a woman reporter who asked him if he was interested in women.
In what?
In women.
In women. Well, for a married man, I suppose being in pictures, one must be interested in humanity, let us say, and particularly in the opposite sex, because our work involves playing human emotions.
Yeah.
Usually with the opposite sex.
Do not forsake me, oh my darling. On this our wedding day, do not forsake me, oh my darling. Wait, Lord.
With the theme from Coop's classic Western High Noon, the voice of a singer who dominated the early 50s, Frankie Lane, along with Dean Martin, Johnny Ray, Edith Piaf, and other pre-rock singers. Sad to say, nowhere in our 50s archive is there any reference or acknowledgement of the birth of that major social revolution sweeping through Europe from the United States. Rock and roll.
Well, since my baby left me, well, I found a new place to dwell. Well, it's down at the end of Lonely Street, that heartbreak hotel where I'll be just a lonely baby. Well, I'm so lonely.
I'll be so lonely I could die.
Well, the King might have arrived along with Haley, Little Richard, and a galaxy of musicians who shook up the decade. But as far as Radio Netherlands was concerned, it was just a passing phase that would fade and be relegated to the dustbin of history. You see, when it came to entertainment, we still relied on our Sunday phenomenon and his weekly diet of corn and cup of cha.
We are going to have a nice cup of tea in your kind company. That comes as a surprise, I hope. But here it is. Clink, clang, come on, sing and sip. Everybody happy.
Do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, ti.
I like a nice cup of tea in the morning. You bet.
Or to start the day, you see. At the half past 11, well, my idea of heaven is a nice cup of tea.
In your company.
I like a nice cup of tea with my dinner. And a nice cup of tea with my tea. And when it's time for bed, there's a lot to be said for a nice cup of tea.
And even though he cost us a fortune in broken crockery, that cup of tea gimmick turned out to be his most famous. Eddie Starts of the Happy Station. In the 50s, you know, it celebrated its 25th anniversary, and Eddie was destined to go on for another decade. But in the second half of the 50s, an era dominated by conflicts in Vietnam, Korea, and Suez, the general attitude of accepting the social and political order began being questioned. And nothing stirred Dutch public outrage as the Soviet Union's brutal suppression of the ill-fated Hungarian revolt in 1956. As Soviet tanks entered Budapest, a spontaneous demonstration took place in Amsterdam outside the headquarters of the Dutch Communist Party as the public expressed their solidarity with the Hungarians in their struggle for freedom.
Feeling is running high in the Netherlands tonight. It is just about 36 hours since the last communications with fallen Budapest, Hungary were broken off. And the fate of those brave Hungarians who fought so desperately for their freedom is unknown. But the people of Holland, the people here in the Netherlands, who have felt the steel heel of the invaders in World War II, have a great sympathy for the brave Hungarians, have a great sympathy now for the fate of those who have fought, and from our last reports are still fighting, against the columns of oppression. And at this moment, Amsterdam, for where we are speaking, is, well, relatively quiet, insofar as there's some cheering from a student group across the Dam Rock, right under the Grand Tower of the Dam Palace.
Public outrage that would gain momentum in the years to come as Amsterdam became notoriously famous as the city of demos. In the 50s, a decade or more after the war, Europe was still peppered by refugee camps housing refugees still waiting to be resettled, many of whom still bore the terrible scars of their ordeal in the Holocaust. Radio Netherlands sponsored a tour of these camps by international broadcasters to record and highlight the plight of those displaced people.
The thing that horrified most of us when we heard the programs was this recording presented by Richard Dimbleby. It is the story of a German Jew who had been used as a human guinea pig by Hitler's doctors.
From Auschwitz to Dachau. 15 operations. 25 injections. 30 in the spine. I don't know if my parents are dead or alive. My own life is over. I don't want to live anymore. They beat me and they beat me. Perhaps someone will help me. I don't want to live anymore. For that one poor mortal, in the name of 300,000 others, I ask your pity.
When all is said and done, the 50s was the season of change that marked the mid-passage of our civilization and lay the foundations for the great social explosions of the 60s. In the next chapter of this series, we'll take a brief look at how this nation and Radio Netherlands reacted and adapted to those issues at home and in a shrinking globe.